Well, thanks to the organizers for putting together such a great meeting and for the opportunity to share some ideas about how we might use spectroscopy to search for evidence in the planet formation region of disks. And before getting started on the main topic there, I just wanted to give a quick comment about these disks that we're studying to comment on exactly how primordial are they, and then go on to describe the ways that we might look for turbulence in these systems, first describing some of the available spectral line diagnostics that we can work with, and then how these, sketching out how these might be used to look for turbulence in three different ways, through a chemical signature, a thermal signature, and turbulent motions, and then try to comment a little bit on what these diagnostics might tell us about disk winds. Okay, so first on how primordial are protoplanetary disks. You know, there's always, people show this plot of how stars grow up from, first they're accreting, then they have accreting from an envelope, they generate outflows, outflows go away, there's just a disk, and then the disk goes away. The sequence of events is a story of how the star grows up. But while the star is growing, it's also another story is going on in parallel, that it may be growing planets, and the story of planet formation, as we know, is a story of transforming small things into big things, going from micron-sized grains to kilometer-sized planetesimals, protoplanets that are thousands of kilometers in size and larger. So when we're thinking about studying disks, we'd like to know, in each of these phases, how far did the disk get in terms of its planet formation? So I didn't want to be left out of showing this plot. And when we look at a plot like this, which is a very young class II source, so pretty early in the stage of evolution, you can see that it looks pretty non-primordial. But what is, this is one source. What is the answer for how evolved is this typical of most disks or not? Alma will probably image a lot of these things and we'll know the answer, but without doing any observations, we could probably guess the answer by making a simple comparison of the solids that are locked up in known exoplanet systems and comparing them to the mass budget for planet formation based on the small amount, small grains, centimeter size and smaller, that's present in the disks, that these sorts of disks. So just to sketch out the argument, if we, this is a project I did with Scott Kenyon, if we add up the populations that are detected through transits, radial velocities, microlensing, and debris disks. Debris disks are the debris that's created by the collisions of leftover planetesimals. And we take the incidence rate for these corrected for the detection efficiencies, and then these planets are all occurring at different radii, so we can Monte Carlo up the different contributions. We end up with a mass function that looks like this, so it's this green line here, showing the cumulative fraction of systems that have a certain amount of solids that are locked up in exoplanets. So 80% of stars have something like 10 Earth masses in solids, and 50% of stars have something like 20 Earth masses in solids locked up in exoplanets. Now if we look at the budget for class II disks, that's shown here in black, and you can see that it matches pretty well. At the upper end, there's enough mass and small grains in disks to explain the most massive exoplanet systems, but there's not enough to explain the lower end. So what does this mean? As a class, class II objects, T. Tauri disks, don't have enough small solids to explain even what we already know is locked up in most exoplanet systems. So if we think that these systems, which may have evolved from these class I disks, if we think these systems are the progenitors of the known exoplanet systems, they must have experienced a significant amount of evolution, having already grown their grains into large things that we can't, large bodies that we can't observe, or concentrated them at small sizes where they're also not readily visible. And there's some chemical evidence to suggest that the sizes that these objects have grown to are a kilometer size or larger. I could discuss that more if anyone's interested. So, but getting back to the main point, what is the nature of these exoplanet, these protoplanetary disks that we're studying? Are they primordial? As a class, no, not so much. They've already experienced a significant amount of evolution. So when I was a grad student, we would talk about these protoplanetary disks as being very primordial, pristine things. Any minute now, something exciting might happen, like planet formation. But now we know that that's not the case. The cork's been popped and the party is on. So when we're thinking about looking for turbulence in these kinds of systems, we should be pretty aware that a lot of other things are also going on, such as planet formation. Okay, so how can we, in studying these disks, how can we probe turbulence in these fairly complex systems where lots of different things are going on? So in the planet formation region of disks, say within 10 AU, disks are optically thick, so we can't look through them, but we can look at the disk surface, the disk photosphere, which is heated by radiation from the star and potentially also by accretion. And thinking about how one studies these atmospheres, what can we learn from spectroscopy? Well, we can measure the abundances of molecules, we can measure the chemistry, we can measure the thermal properties of the atmosphere and maybe look at heating, and we can measure the motions of material in the atmosphere. So first let's look at some of the diagnostics that we have to work with. So this is a very schematic picture of a disk going from the disk truncation radius at 0.05 AU, say, out to 1 AU and then 10 AU. And some of the diagnostics that we have available to probe the region close to the star include UV fluorescent transitions of molecular hydrogen. We also have emission features of simple molecules like CO, OH, water, and organics. And the same molecules are also present at larger radii in the mid-infrared. Now, what do some of these diagnostics look like? So looking at the near-infrared diagnostics, we have the, at 2.3 microns, we have the CO overtone transitions. These are delta V of two transitions. And here are the lines approaching and receding from the 2 to 0 band head. We also have the CO fundamental transitions, which are at 5 microns, delta V of 1 transitions. And here are V equals 1 to 0, 2 to 1, and 3 to 2 kinds of transitions. And in the L band, here at 3 microns, there are emission lines of water and OH. You can also think about how common are these, how commonly do these diagnostics occur. The overtone occurs pretty rarely in 5 to 10% of young stars. That's because it requires high temperature and high column densities to produce the emission, whereas the CO fundamental, which is has much more lenient conditions, doesn't require as high temperature or column density, that's detected in practically all systems. This kind of emission may be common. We can definitely see that it's there when the emission is strong, and when it becomes weak, it can be confused with the structure in the underlying stellar photosphere. So not too sure about that. However, sometimes the emission in the L band is extremely strong. It's very rich, and in fact, the entire L band is filled with emission lines of water and OH. So how do we learn about the atmosphere? When we have resolved line profiles, we can use them to infer the properties of the atmosphere as a function of distance. So for example, emission from high velocities comes from close in and lower velocities from further out. And these kinds of CO fundamental emission profiles tell us that the emission, for example, is coming from 0.05 AU at the disk truncation radius out to something like an AU. Now there's an equivalent sort of thing that we can do in the mid-infrared, although it's more challenging. And one of the exciting developments in recent years was the discovery that the mid-infrared spectrum of T. Tauri disks is extremely rich. It's filled with emission lines of water and OH and organic molecules. And this is just a blow-up of that region here where there's, you can see there's acetylene, hydrogen cyanide, carbon dioxide, and water. And we can, it's more challenging to work in the mid-infrared, but when the emission is very bright, we can spectrally resolve the emission lines using ground-based telescopes. So here's some resolved line profiles of water in blue and HCN in red. And these line profiles, again, are telling us that the emission is coming from the terrestrial planet region of the disk. So we know the radii from which the emission comes from. And what if we wanted to know the height in the disk where the emission comes from? For that, one way to approach that is to make some models of disk atmospheres. So here we have at half an AU going down into the disk. So as we go down into the disk, looking at the thermal structure and the chemical structure in the atmosphere. And generally what we find is that there's a hot atomic layer that's maybe something like 4,000 or 5,000 degrees. And below it is a hot, warm molecular layer, maybe 400 to 2,000 degrees. And below that is a cooler molecular layer. And you know, these molecules that we've just been discussing are present in this region. Now, it's interesting that the temperature of this warm, hot, warm molecular layer, 400 to 2,000 degrees, is very similar to the kinds of temperatures that these diagnostics emit at. And so possibly these features are coming from the warm molecular layer, and the hot atomic region is producing some of the atomic diagnostics that we see. And these temperatures here are all much hotter than the equivalent dust temperatures at the same radii. Okay, so how can we use these diagnostics then to tell us something about turbulence? Because, you know, we know these same disks are accreting as a function of time. And how do they do that? And it's pretty interesting to try to probe, use these diagnostics of the planet formation region to see whether disks are MRI active or not. And so there might be three ways, I can think of three ways that we could look for evidence of turbulence in this region of the disk. So first, one possibility would be chemical mixing. And so here, you know, you have a piece, you have some dust and gas, and it's migrating around radially and vertically. And we're looking for something that's chemically out of place. So for example, you might take some cold, icy stuff from the midplane and loft it into the disk atmosphere and then see something that doesn't belong there. So that's an interesting idea. One of the challenges, though, with doing that is that the chemical time scale in the disk atmosphere is very short. So here's a plot from work by Peter Wojtka, but I think most people find the same thing. So here's height in the disk and radius. And the chemical time scale in the disk midplane, because it's cold, is very long. But once you get up into the disk atmosphere, it's warmer, and the chemical time scale is short. And so material that you might loft from the midplane up to the surface is generally chemically erased, at least for the diagnostics that we currently work with at the radii that we're studying. So there might be a different answer for working further away here, or for other species that we haven't really looked at. So that might be something interesting to work on. I'll just skip over this part. Okay, so a little bit challenging there for chemical mixing, but there are some possible approaches. Okay, what about looking for a thermal effect? Because as we were discussing, these diagnostics that we see are pretty hot compared to the dust temperature. And so could some of this heating, that high temperature material that we see, be powered by accretion heating? And this seems plausible because in contrast to an alpha disk, where most of the energy would be dissipated in the midplane, in a magnetorotational instability disk, most of the accretion occurs higher in the atmosphere, and the heating at this would be deposited, the energy would be deposited higher in the atmosphere. And in this nice paper by Hidoshi and Turner, we see that the amount of heating in the atmosphere is large, perhaps equivalent to an alpha of unity. And so if could that kind of heating be responsible for producing these diagnostics? In order to investigate that, we need to rule out other possible heating mechanisms. And an obvious one there is the role of the stellar UV in its impact on the disk. So looking here at these models that we were just looking at earlier, what's doing the heating? It turns out that here we've put in both accretion mechanical heating, where alpha is a half, and UV photochemical heating, where there's Lyman alpha and continuum photons. So in the hot atomic region, the disk is heated by mechanically and by grade photoelectric heating. But in the hot, warm molecular region, it's heated by UV photochemical heating, so absorption by molecules, and mechanical heating. And then deeper in this cooler molecular layer, mechanical heating dominates. So to judge whether mechanical heating here is really playing a role in explaining any of the known diagnostics, we have to somehow convert all of this stuff into a comparison with the observations. So I didn't make a pie chart, but I made these boxes. So here are some boxes, one for each of the molecules that we were just looking at. Okay, so here we have UV fluorescent molecular hydrogen, CO, OH, water, HCN, etc. And in each box, we have the column density of the emission over a given size in this particular temperature range. So sorry, it's a little bit complicated, but basically the idea is that these colored boxes illustrate the properties of the observed feature that, for example, H2 has a column density of 10 to the 19, it has an average temperature of 2,500 degrees, and it comes, it emits in a region smaller than an AU. And then in comparison, I plotted the column that's seen in the model as a function of radius in this temperature range. So to the extent that the lines are in the box, the model's doing pretty good in capturing the pretty well in capturing this essence of the emission. So the colored lines show where there's UV and mechanical heating, and the gray lines have no mechanical heating. So the difference between these two lines is a measure of whether the importance of mechanical heating. So you can see that in these hot molecular components, their mechanical heating is not important because these lines are almost the same. But for some of these cooler diagnostics like water or carbon dioxide, the mechanical heating is enhancing the emission. So basically, I guess, just taking a step back, I would say that the observations can be best explained when there's both UV and mechanical heating, but Lyman alpha UV radiation does much of the heavy lifting. So, and that's not too surprising, because most of the emission is coming from this hot, warm molecular region where the FUV was important. So if we want to get a clearer signature of mechanical heating, a heat signature of accretion, we might look here in this cooler molecular layer because that's the region where mechanical heating was dominating. How big a signature could that be? Well, in this region here, if we look at the column density as a function of radius, in the temperature range 90 to 400 degrees, there, when you have mechanical heating and when you don't, the column in this temperature range is larger by a factor of 10 to 3, and molecules like CO are very abundant in this region. So looking for CO in this temperature range might be a signature of mechanical heating. But of course, there's some caveats which I have to mention. So for example, I just assumed that alpha had a value of a half, but I don't know if that's the right answer, and maybe it varies with height in the atmosphere. So if people have some prescriptions that we should be using instead, that would be good to know. Also, we made a very approximate implementation of Lyman alpha radiative transfer, the scattering and absorption in the atmosphere, and a really detailed model that is coupled to the chemistry could potentially change the amount of heating there. So more detailed work is quite welcome. Okay, third option would be to study turbulent line broadening in the atmosphere. And here, that seems like quite a good idea because as we go further from the disk midplane, the turbulent velocity fluctuations should rise with height in the atmosphere, reaching something like the sound speed. And we actually made some progress on this idea 15 years before this paper was written, where accidentally we found some evidence for turbulence by looking at the CO overtone emission at 2.3 microns. So here are the lines approaching and receding from the band head. And the emission from the disk might look like that if the disk wasn't rotating. But of course, it's rotating, and the line profile for a single line might look something like this. And so if we convolve these two, we end up with a spectrum like this, which fits the observations. And in order to get a good fit, we found that we needed to have some amount of turbulent line broadening. And the reason why we're sensitive to the amount of turbulent broadening, even if the disk is spatially unresolved, is because the lines close to the bandhead probe the interline spacing of the lines close to the bandhead are comparable to the amount of non-thermal line broadening. And so because overlapping line wings will have significant optical depth when it's not optically thin, you can actually extract what is the intrinsic line broadening from a spectrum like that. So here's another example. There are a handful of examples from both emission and I think absorption that Lee did with Fiori. And these kinds of observations show that the amount of turbulent Brodny is comparable to the sound speed. That would be great, except one drawback is that this emission is really coming from close to the star, where the disk should be hot enough that thermoionization alone could drive the mediator rotational instability. So what we really want to do is find an equivalent to this in the more dead region of the disk. So what are some opportunities for doing that? Well, one possibility is to look at spectra like these, which have, the critical thing, of course, is to find transitions that have the interline spacing that's comparable to the amount of non-thermal line broadening. So you need closely spaced lines that you know the properties very well. Okay, so, for example, this kind of spectrum is pretty exciting because there's a lot of lines and they're very close together, and some of these might be really good. And the only problem with this situation is that the line list for this region is not good enough, so it's pretty much hopeless. So until we know more. However, here in the mid-infrared, there are a lot of lines of water, for example, and perhaps some of those have the appropriate spacing to look for non-thermal broadening. So that's an interesting topic that we might even work on at the workshop to try to identify some appropriate diagnostics. Okay, so it seems like there's a little time, so maybe I could mention what do these diagnostics say about winds. So in all of these diagnostics that we've been talking about, we never see large velocity offsets for the molecular emission, nor do we see blue-shifted absorption features. For example, if we're looking down at the disk, we might see this disk wind with blue-shifted absorption. So we don't see any of those things. So I'm not sure if that's consistent or not with the properties of disk winds. Maybe the disk winds are not molecular, and so that's why there's no obvious signature. Another idea is that we heard yesterday that in order to power these winds, we need to have energetic photons, UV and X-rays, heating up the wind. I was a little nervous when I heard that because I need all those photons in order to heat up the disk atmosphere to explain the observations that I see. So you can have some, but don't take them all because I really need them. However, if the wind really does absorb and scatter away a lot of the UV photons, that would deprive the disk of all the heating that I just told you about. And so if that were the case, then that would open up the door for more mechanical heating. Okay, so what's my conclusions? Where people agree that we should see turbulence, we do. So close to the star where there should be thermally ionized, enough thermal ionization to drive the MRI, we see turbulence when we can. Where the disk might be dead, we don't. We don't have any evidence for turbulence in that region, but neither can we rule it out because, for example, we haven't identified a good chemical diagnostic of mixing. There might be some role for a heat signature there, but I think a better, more definitive signature would come from looking deeper down in the disk, and we don't yet have a good good diagnostic of line broadening. So I'll just stop there. Thank you.
Well, first, a couple of comments. On the question of the alpha value in these upper layers, you want to explain accretion rates of 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year through accretion in active layers that only have a column of a few grams per square centimeter. You need a pretty substantial alpha in that region.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the chemical equilibration timescales, looking at your plot, it looked like those blue regions timescales of order a year.
Yeah.
That may be a short time for hydrostatic models, but not necessarily for wind models. But the flow times can be comparable to that.
Sure.
Finally, a question.
What do you think is the implication of that?
Well, if you have a photoevaporative or magnetothermal wind coming off the disk surface, mm-hmm. the float time to that height may be short enough that you can still see, you know, out of equilibrium chemical effects.
Right.
Boydke et al. Tend to make these hydrostatic models.
Sure.
You know, which are probably not realistic.
But then wouldn't that tend to preserve molecules in the wind that we might see? Would that be the implication?
That might be the hope. But then you have to worry about the FUV radiation field, and it's complicated. But I'm just saying.
I just want to tie it to the observation. So.
is not necessarily very, very short.
Sure.
Sure. Finally, a question. You said H2O Lyme lists are poor. I mean, should we not believe theoretical lists like Barbara Tennyson?
Well, a lot of that work is created to explain, say, stellar photospheres. And so if you want to, not necessarily in great detail, but to get their spectral energy distribution for, say, cooling in brown dwarf evolution or something like that. So if you just want a sampling of opacity over, and it doesn't have to be very accurate in the exact wavelengths and A values, then that kind of work is terrific. I'm not criticizing any particular paper, but there are many good approximations for opacity sampling in atmospheres. But when you want to do, you want to know exactly what, you need accurate wavelengths, accurate A values, so that you can diagnose small changes that would be due to non-thermal line broadening. That's where it becomes a little challenging, even for a molecule as simple as water.
So if you are successful at identifying some lines in the mid-infrared to do this, does the instrumentation exist to make the observations you want to make?
Some of the TXEs, the Gemini spectra that I showed, those were of water lines. So if it's something strong like that, then yeah.
I have to ask the crazy question, which is, are we going to be able to detect magnetic fields directly?
Do you have a prediction for what we would see?
I'd rather you told us from the observations first.
Okay. I guess we should talk about what strengths are expected, and I guess whether any diagnostics we are working with have some Zeeman sensitivity.
That might be very interesting to discuss.
Yeah. Any other questions?
So I thought from the talks yesterday that the observation showed that there wasn't any good observations of turbulence.
Close to the star, I think everybody predicts that thermal ionization would enable turbulence, and that's where we do actually find a signature of it.
Okay, so it was the observations yesterday, we're talking about the more distant regions in the
right, so very large radii. Yeah.
Like 30 AU or beyond, right? Hundreds of AU.
Just to repeat that, the methods that I was talking about yesterday don't work at all at these radii. They only work at tens and more often hundreds of astronomical units. So this is a totally different region of the disk.
So the Hermes instrument on Sophia is being built, right? That'll offer 3 kilometer second resolution, and you'll be able to get water lines.
What is the wavelength for Hermes? I forgot.
It's going to go 30 or something like that, all the way up to the HD line and 112. So you're able to get oxygen and a whole host of water lines. And I think maybe that's a very fruitful avenue for this work in a couple of years.
Yeah, that's true. Great. Yeah. Thanks, Ted.
with these mid-infrared lines, how important is it to get above the Earth's atmosphere?
That's a good question. So for the lines that I was showing, the ground-based spectroscopy, the emission is warm enough that the there isn't significant absorption, telluric absorption in our atmosphere, because our atmosphere is cooler than the emission lines that we're looking at. If we go to, if we're looking at a diagnostic that is more comparable to the temperature in of the disk, then I think you'd have to go to SOFIA, where you'd be in the stratosphere and have a better chance of doing that sort of thing. So going to, trying to extend what we're doing to larger radii, cooler part of the disk, makes it more important to be above the atmosphere.
So in the modeling that you do of the band heads with, you know, where you convolve that with a rotational broadening profile, mm-hmm. So the profile you were using certainly looked like you were assuming that the line forming layer is optically thin. Is that right?
No, for the diagnostic that we were working with, it's optically thick.
But the profile you used is clearly that of an optically thin rotating disk. If you look at Martian Horn, the center of the rotational broadening profile.
That's just a measure of the these are all optically thick disks. So you can synthesize any profile you want if you have some intensity as a function of radius.
No, there's a local velocity shear issue, which basically changes the escape probability from the local from the layer that was explored in CV disks, for example, by Martian Horn. So I think you don't.
Not for these objects, right? I mean, you know, we've done it both in absorption and emission.
You
get the same thing, right?
Sorry?
If you are absorption, your emission, you get the same line profiles. Just doing actual radiative transfer, not escape probability.
Okay, sure, that'd be great.
Going once. All right, so let's thank Joan again.